For those who don't like to listen to me, they can read many of the things I'm talking about. In particular, all the references which I don't give can be found in that article. I begin with some explanations. I tell you what I mean with completing. Certainly, I don't mean the thing is complete, but I have the feeling we are getting close to it. And what I want to explain is what the situation is and what needs to be done. And I think there's now a clear path along which one could go. The picture in the title refers to this picture. I think you all know this. It has been drawn for the first time 40 years ago, and there was quite a discussion about this. I guess you remember the idea was to rescale the space-time and asymptotically flat space-time, and Penrose suggested that we can describe the asymptotic behavior by adjusting the rescaling such that infinity becomes finite and the fields can be extended smoothly through null infinity, or at least with certain amount of certain degree of smoothness. Now, it's nice to draw these pictures, but maybe for those who are not so familiar with this, I should point out that it's much nicer to draw the pictures and really draw conclusions about this. There are two well-known experts in gravity and PDE theory who wrote in their big book, it's questionable whether non-trivial solutions with this behavior which is required there really exist. If experts write this, one should be a little bit concerned. And one may wonder why one nevertheless insists on analyzing the situation. The reasons are the following, or some of the reasons are the following. The first is, if we can establish this picture, it will be of considerable help in interpretation of space-times and data and so on. It will simplify various concepts. And in particular, it will tell us in particular how the idea of an asymptotically flat space-time should be formed.
I think I heard in the conference people talking about computing.
I come to this. I come to this. Yeah. Okay.
Computing is what you said. What it says there. In that sense, there exists no trivial asymptotic solutions vacuum equations. You're saying that they were arguing.
Usually, if you are writing, the time flow is this way. Yeah. you should not start with the end.
Oh, because I thought you said two experts, and I was looking for the
question. It's not those two experts, it's other two experts. Those didn't write a big book, yes. It's just two other experts who wrote a big book, yeah. Now, it also gives insight into the equations. If one really wants to do a sharp analysis, one has to look very, very careful, and it will deepen our understanding of the equation, of gauge conditions, and so on. And it also gives support for numerical analysis if we have a good understanding of asymptotically flat space-time. If you know what we can expect, we have something to tell the numerical guys what they should watch for, and I think that should help. And in the end, you have to develop various mathematical tools, and these tools themselves will allow an approach to special calculations of such space-times. And if you really want to calculate the complete space-time, you have to start from Cauchy data, calculate into the future and into the past. And part of what I'm going to talk about is to formulate initial value problems such that you can do that. Of course, there is being numerical work done already on this. It starts from hyperboloidal hypersurface, where the analytical situation is well understood. Another question is how the numerics works, and we have an expert here, this is Sascha Huser, and he can tell you much more about this, so I'm not going to talk about it. Now, recently, Kostel and Delay showed that there do exist non-trivial asymptotically simple solution of the vacuum field equation, which have a prescribed smoothness on squi. This result relies on new insights on the constraints which derived from work of Schön and Corvino. Kostel and Delay extended this work, and they found in particular a class of data with the following property. They are quite general in the interior. They are exactly Schwarzschild outside a given fixed radius, and you have a family of such data which approach Minkowski space. In that case, you have perfect control of the solution near space-like infinity. You know that there exist smooth hyperboloidal hypersurfaces, and there was a result which I have shown a few years ago, which tell you if these hyperboloidal hypersurfaces or the hyperboloidal data are sufficiently close to Minkowskian data, you get the whole space-time in the future. Since the data they looked at were time symmetric, so you get the whole picture. It's nice to know that these things are not ruled out by the Einstein equations, but it does not answer our main question. These results are still, these space times are still very special in being Schwarzschild near space-like infinity. But the main question is how many asymptotically simple space-time exist? If there are only few, we would say it's not really useful for modeling physical system. We want to have a perfect control, and we want to see that there are many. So the basic question is, if we prescribe Cauchy data, can we read off from the structure of the Cauchy data whether the solution will develop in something which is asymptotically simple? Since the future of hyperboloidal hypersurfaces is under good control, it's clear any questions concerning the smoothness are decided near space-like infinity. So what we need is complete information on an arbitrary neighborhood of space-like infinity. I should say, because people think he likes to draw this picture with these points up here, that this is not all we want to do. Of course, we would like to have generalization of this situation where you have sources floating around. Then these points are not any longer regular points in the space-time. And of course, we also would like to have the situation which everybody here is interested in, where you have black holes, and you have even here in this picture a merger of black holes. One question which I find interesting is whether this situation can exist at all. That black hole developed from something which has nice smooth data on past null infinity. I have no idea. But I just want to point out, when I'm referring...
Yeah? The question whether a single black hole can form or whether this binary black hole system...
Any of the situation. I don't know.
What about surely just the scalar rays imploding?
Pardon?
What about spherical scalar rays imploding?
Scalar rays is not a black hole, no?
Well, we produce a black hole.
No, vacuum. I'm talking about vacuum.
Yeah.
I'm doing poor vacuum. I've not.
You've got gravitational waves, that's hard.
Okay, thank you. Oh, yeah, with Miss Meta, there's no question. Yeah. No, it's a vacuum case. Okay, I just wanted to say, if I draw these wonderful picture with the I plus and I minus, that's not the end of it. It's just in analytical discussion, it's nice to have these because you have perfect control over the completeness of the solutions. Anyway, what I said suggests our main concern will be with space like infinity. Now, you remember the embedding of Minkowski space into the Einstein cosmos. That's a picture you have. And if you draw the picture like this, you see that space like infinity is represented there by a point. And so we look at a situation like this. Now, if you do this, and you do this the way I like to do it, you want to see whether you can use the conformal vacuum field equation to get any results about this. And if you try to do this, you find the following. You consider the initial data for the Einstein equation, for the conformal field equations on some hypersurface, and you look how they behave near space like infinity. There's a point I, that this point, that's a part of this hypersurface. And there's a point I zero, which is space like infinity with respect to the space-time. So when I'm on the hypersurface, I only have this point I. If I look at the space-time as a whole, I have this point I zero, which of course then coincides with this point I. Now, anyway, you look at the data near the point I, and you find they explode. They explode in a terrible way. They are not even integrable there. So that's a problem which we have to analyze. Now, in trying to understand what the singularity does, in trying to find a description which tells me clearly what it looks like and what consequences it has, I ended up with another picture, and that's this one. In this picture, the point I on the initial hypersurface is replaced by a spherical set I0. The point I0, space-like infinity with respect to the space-time, is replaced by a cylinder which I call I. Oh, I didn't write the I here. Okay, this cylinder is a cylinder at space-like infinity. And square plus and square minus, they are just touching the cylinder at sets I plus, a spherical set I plus, and a spherical set I minus. I should say, this picture is not imposed. It gets out, if you get it out from the field equation and the conformal geometry, it's a consequence of it if you listen carefully. So,
and fields are smooth on that cylinder?
Yes, that's the next statement. That's a point of the whole thing. I've been trying to get a setting in which I discuss the field equation, yeah? And it turns out, and I should say, it has worked out in detail so far for the time symmetric case, but there are results which show that it should also work in the non-time symmetric case. It's just so much algebra involved. You are happy if you get one case settled. So the data for the conformal field equations are smooth on S-twiddle, which is a physical hypersurface, and extends smoothly through this set I0.
You might use the point if you cover it up.
Okay. And what you also find is that you can write the field equation in a way such that they extend in a smooth way to the cylinder, and they are symmetric hyperbolic everywhere. I should say this is something which I did not expect, and it's something which is very special to the Einstein equation. There are certainly subtleties about the smoothness, which I will point out later. The way the equation extend is also very, very remarkable. And I think it depends very much on this particular differential system we are looking at. And it turns out that in this picture, you get a most concise formulation of the problem we want to solve. I'm trying to explain what I mean by that. So just to see what the thing looks like from the outside, That was our original picture. And then we do this blow up of space like infinity. You get this cylinder here to which Scry attaches. So in the following, I will also always refer to this particular picture. And we need to know there's a coordinate T which goes up, which you can consider on the physical part, which is outside here, as the time coordinate. There's a coordinate R, which is a radial coordinate, which vanishes on the cylinder. And the gauge conditions are such that T is equal to 1 on this critical set and equal to minus 1 on this critical set. And there are angular coordinates. So this is a picture we have to keep in mind for the following. The conformal field equation imply in this gauge, which is underlying this picture, reduced equations for an unknown, which I sometimes write U, and then I split it into subsets, this U, and the V is consisting of, coefficients of a frame field, connection coefficients with respect to a certain wire connection, and its Ricci tensor, and of this tensor, where this is the conformal Y tensor, and this is the conformal factor, which vanishes on Scry and which vanishes on the cylinder. So for these unknowns, I get reduced equation of this type. What's remarkable here, this is essentially an ordinary differential equation. And the rescaled conformal Weyl tensor is governed by a partial differential equation, which looks like this. It's coming from the Bianchi equations. If one looks at the form of this equation, if one looks at the data, one finds that there exists a solution and which is smooth and extends smoothly up to the cylinder I in a neighborhood of S. Our job is to control how far it exists and what's the smoothness property if we go to Scry. Now, if you look at the picture, you might think the cylinder is a kind of boundary. It is a boundary, but it's very, very special. It's special insofar as this matrix vanishes on the boundary. So if you cancel this matrix, you see you get an interior equation on the boundary, something very special. It follows that you don't only get interior equation on the boundary, but you for the unknown, but also for these derivatives. And we can, to some extent, solve these equations. Unfortunately, not quite. And there is an important open question. What we can do, we expand everything in terms of spherical harmonics or something like that. We get ordinary differential equation on the cylinder. And we can reduce the calculation of UP to expressions of this form, where U is a complex two-vector, X of T is a matrix, 2x2 matrix. These are the initial data for Y. And there is this functional B. B is a functional of the quantities U0 bis U pi minus 1. So in principle, recursively, you can determine all these y of t. And from them, you can derive all these up. In principle, you get a formal expansion.
I'm embarrassed to say I'm a little mixed up here. Right? The data is on S, is it? Or is it on S plus?
No, it's on S.
It's on S.
The data are on S. And what I've been saying here, maybe I was too short, sorry, is this thing vanishes on the cylinder, yeah? So you forget about this on the cylinder. Then you have in this differential system which is interior to the cylinder. It's symmetric hyperbolic. It inherits this property because the whole system is symmetric hyperbolic. So the solution on the cylinder is determined uniquely by the data on the set where the cylinder intersects S. There's no freedom to prescribe boundary data.
How did this miracle happen? What's so special about the cylinder?
That is special about the cylinder.
You might expect the mechanism to just be flat or something.
No. This is no. It's just. Logically, it's difficult to say how it happened. I mean, you could say, I did it, yeah? But that's not what you want. What's happening here is the cylinder is itself not a geometrical object with respect to G mu nu. If you extend try to extend the metric to the cylinder, you get difficulties in this gauge, underlying this picture. The contravariant version of G mu nu has a smooth limit.
Yeah? The rescale version.
No. If you take the contravariant version of it, yeah. What's happening is, you get expression which look like this. I come back to this later. Okay. Then you see it clearly. Yeah? No. It's not intuitive at all. I mean. It cost me about 15 years to end up with this picture. Yeah, it's not obvious at all.
Maybe it would help with the intuition. I mean, I usually think that there's no dynamics in spatial affinity.
Yes.
Nothing really evolves there.
We see it's not quite correct. Yeah.
So this is some non-trivial evolution of some dynamic.
Yes, there's something going on, and that's what makes the problem. Yeah. Yeah, one could say there's a lot more life at space like infinity than we thought, yeah?
Are you saying there's evolution in some sense?
That's an evolution system, yeah? But the point is, you prescribe and you look at the data on the set E0, and everything is determined on cylinder by these data. And not only the unknown, but also their derivative with respect to this radial coordinates.
If we just had fields evolving in Minkowski space, would we have something?
Yes. You can write down this gauge in Minkowski space, and you get the same picture. I come back to this. You have make a special rescaling and a special coordinate transformation. The rescaling is not the usual rescaling. The usual rescaling is such that on the slice S, omega, the conformal factor, goes to zero like R squared, if R is the non-physical distance from space like infinity. This does not. It goes to infinity like R. I don't know whether it helps with your intuition. If I said the cylinder is not geometric with respect to the metric. But you can make a coordinate transformation such that everything becomes finite in the metric coefficients. But this coordinate transformation shifts the cylinder again to infinity. And that's not what I want to have, because I want to do calculations. Yeah. So what is important is, while the metric itself does not stay regular, the rescaled metric, yeah, the contravariant version does stay regular. And frame fields can also stay regular. They correspond to the contravariant version of the metric, yeah, with the index position. And what happens is, you have a radial tensor, a radial vector field, which vanishes on the cylinder. So the frame degenerates, but it stays smooth. Yeah, that's an important point. And some of our problems are related to this. Maybe I should not say it this way, because it sounds as if I'm creating problems for myself. Yeah, it's in the system, but we will see what the consequences are.
I look at the wild number Jupiter metrics. Would they have this time dependence or?
I must confess, I didn't check it for all the metrics in the world, but I mean, if they are sufficiently nice, I mean, the initial data at space like infinity, and if they are time-like, this thing applies. Yeah, it's very general.
Static.
I come back to the static solutions. Yeah, I come back to this. So, we can, to some extent, calculate the UPs. We get expressions of this form, and I will tell you in a minute more about these expressions. So I said the cylinder is very special because you have this, but it turns out that also the critical sets, the sets where the cylinder touches square plus and square minus, are very special. Since you know the unknown by solving the equations on the cylinder, you know the matrices on the cylinder, and you find that AT, the determinant of AT, is going to zero on these special sets. Now, I told you before, this system is symmetric hyperbolic in the neighborhood of the initial hypersurface. This condition tells you that this hyperbolicity breaks down on the critical sets. In general, you find that you have logarithmic terms in the UP as t goes to plus minus infinity. I just considered here the future. So that's following from this. It's following by a detailed calculation considering this here. And I'm going to discuss how it comes about. So one can refer to this situation that by saying that in general UP has a polyhomogeneous expansion. It does not explain, it's just a word for this situation. Now what happens if we look at these expressions more carefully? It turns out there are two different sources of logarithmic singularities. There is one source which has to do with the XT. There are certain of the matrices XT which behaves like this here. The K is becoming larger and larger the higher the P is, so for higher order differentiability this becomes more and more harmless. But nevertheless, it's there. In the particular case where the X behave like this, one finds that the B's vanishes. So if we compare this is expression again, yeah, you see, in that case, we only need to care about the first term. And that's nice because these are initial data. We have them perfectly under control, and we have to see what we can do to the initial data to make the thing regular. And it turns out, by going through somewhat lengthy calculations, that you can exclude the occurrence of log terms coming from this here if you pose on the initial data a particular condition. Here I'm referring to the picture where space-like infinity is represented by one point on the initial hypersurface, and this point is called I. The initial data in the time-symmetric case are given by a 3-metric. You take the Cartan tensor of the 3-metric, that's the object which tells you, if it vanishes, that the space-time is conformally flat. So you take the Cartan tensor of H, you take a series of derivative, and you take the symmetric tracery part of it and require it to vanish at that point I. Looks awfully complicated, but I think it's still a very nice and close condition if you think of what it's supposed to do. So there are no log terms if you choose P star to be infinity. There are log terms only of higher order if you have a finite a set of these conditions only. For later discussion, I remark that if you linearize the whole setting, these things are non-trivial after linearization. So, and there is the other part, which refers to the second part of our formula. It refers to this here. That would be nice if the matrices are smooth and regular. But you find that they can be written as products with the one factor Y is a nice matrix which has non-vanishing determinant in the range we are interested in. And there's another matrix which is singular. And then thinking of this integral where you have the inverse of X, you see that you may get logarithmic terms and it depends on the function B. And the function B is quite difficult to calculate. It's quite complicated procedure to get this function B. In principle, you know it can be calculated recursively, but in practice it's complicated. I will say more about this case. That's completely understood. For later discussion, I remark that if you linearize the whole setting, then this part goes away. It's not seen any longer. So this refers to the non-linearity, and it's quite difficult to get hold of. Now, what's the implication of these logarithmic terms for null infinity? Does it destroy the smoothness of null infinity? That's not easy to answer, and if I could answer this, I would have given a different talk. What we do is we linearize the whole setting and look what we can learn from the linearized situation. I linearize this in a particular gauge. This has certain technical reason. I have this picture. Whether this goes under 45 degrees or 57 degrees or under 0 degrees, that's a choice of gauge. And for my discussion, it's convenient to have it under 0 degrees. So the picture looks somewhat different from before. And because we have this camera here and it should be used at least once, I think I draw the picture to remind you of this situation.
If you sketch too lightly, there's no light
for the camera. Oh, I sketch too what?
Lightly.
Oh, sorry. So these are the null generators on those hypersurfaces, yeah?
There is a light switch over on that.
So that's a situation we discuss. And if you linearize, you see what's left over. What's interesting is the equation coming from the Bianchi equations. And in the particular gauge we have, these Bianchi equations imply evolution equation, which look like this here. These terms are not particularly interesting. The vector fields x plus and x minus, they are just angular vector fields. Here you see, again, this particular behavior on the cylinder. This term goes away for r equals to 0, which happens on the cylinder. And here you see these terms, which indicate the degeneracy, which I mentioned before. In this case, you have the degeneracy everywhere on Sgwai. This could be removed by choosing a gauge where Sgwai goes like that. But it cannot be removed at this point at the sets I plus and I minus. It's just for these consideration, it's convenient to have this degeneracy this way. Now, what do we do if we have such a system? Perhaps after multiplication with a few numbers, it's symmetric hyperbolic. Symmetric hyperbolicity is invented such that you get energy estimates, and you go along the usual procedure, and you see the energy estimates give you the following. I consider the slicing here, which is given by my coordinates, and I find the L2 norm of phi on this hypersurface can be estimated by the L2 norm of phi on this hypersurface, where I get a factor like this. And this is good enough to say something if you stay below squi, but it gets useless if t prime goes to 1. So you're not going to gain any control from this estimate. You can do something different. You define suitable subject spaces, and you don't estimate phi, but you estimate its derivatives. And if the derivatives are high enough relative to the differentiability, which you assume, which is considered in the Sobolev spaces, you get an estimate of this type, where C can be chosen to be constant. That's the reason is that we are on the finite set. So in principle, you know that all these norms are bounded on any of these sets, and then you can use the Sobolev inequality to show that these things have a certain differentiability, where the P must be chosen higher than the J. You can prescribe the J, and then you know I have to take so and so many derivatives of the phi to get something which is of class CJ. And this tells you you can do the following. To get from the phis, from the derivatives of phis, you have to integrate along these hypersurfaces. That means you need initial data here. And these initial data you get by solving on the cylinder. The quantities you get by solving on the cylinder, I call phi pi, as before. I assume them to be extended into the space-time such that they are independent of R. And then I get for phi such an expansion. And it follows from this discussion that this part is of a prescribed smoothness. So I get phi as a sum of something which is of prescribed smoothness and something on which I have detailed knowledge. I can calculate these things. And I find if the linearized version of the irregularity condition, which I considered before, is satisfied, then all the log terms here go away and the solution is smooth. If not satisfied, I get log terms here, and these log terms, they travel along squi. So this tells us that in general, we can also expect a non-smoothness on squi. In a way, I was somewhat shocked that the argument should be so easy, but that's how it turns out, and I think it's one of the virtues of the underlying pictures. I should make remarks about this. We had a discussion already before which was going into this direction. You might wonder whether I'm creating the problems myself. Now, the solution is determined uniquely by the physical initial data. We just try to analyze it, and we get log terms. And these log terms are then uniquely determined by these data. They are not generated by the setting. And by the discussion we have seen, we saw that this particular degeneracy we have and at the set shows us exactly how the logarithmic singularities come into existence. So it's the most precise way of saying they are generated. I should say it's the interaction of this degeneracy with the structure of the data. This is clear. If you go to the nonlinear case, this will not improve the situation, and we can expect log terms in general. The positive statement I made that if the regularity conditions are satisfied, the solution will be smooth, is not something about which we can draw any conclusion if you go from the linear to the nonlinear situation. Anyway, the result tells us that there are two main jobs we have to do. The first is we have to analyze the behavior of the function UPs on the cylinder. We have to analyze it in terms of the initial data. When do they get log terms? And we want to have necessary and sufficient regularity conditions. And in the next step, we want to analyze what it does to the smoothness of Squire. So if possible, we would like to generalize the procedure we had in the linear situation. In the following, I will mainly be concerned with this problem here. Since I will be talking about regularity conditions and different versions of it, I will refer to this particular regularity condition as the regularity condition star. So this regularity condition turns out to be necessary and sufficient for the cases p equals 1, 0, 1, 2, 3. That was obtained mainly by doing explicit calculations. And you see how the expressions grow at each order. Also, the word grows at each order. And then you get a little bit frustrated. Juan Valiente Cohen, who has been working as a postdoc in our institute, he used an algebraic computer program to do such calculations. And to simplify this, he studied first data which are conformally flat near space like infinity. There's still many information in these data. These are, data are still quite general, so you can have a huge set on which the Cartan tensor does not vanish. It just vanishes near space-like infinity. And the information from this part to space-like infinity is carried by the solution of the Lichtenherrich equation. So you have the solution of the Lichtenherrich equation, and it contains all the information about the interesting part. Now, he did the calculation of the integral, and he found U4 is still analytic. Then he calculates the next order, and he finds U5 is something which is analytic on the cylinder, and a term which has a logarithm in it, and this has some function of the angular coordinates C5. In fact, these things are constants, and they are related to the Penrose constant. So there is coming a log term in the fifth order. You require again that this thing is not there. Do the next calculation, get the same structure. Then things are already getting quite complicated, even with this computer program. You assume axial symmetry, do the same calculation, get the same result. I think he went up to p equals 8 in that case, and has the same result. So the first shocking thing is these constants do not any longer depend on the local geometry near space-like infinity, which is given by this metric H, which allowed us to write down the regularity condition star, but it seems to have information about the whole space-time. That's bad. If I want to write down a regularity condition which involves everything, it's very complicated. I would never be able to say, I can prescribe data which are supposed to have these and these conditions, and then I get something smooth. If I need the solution of the Lichtenherrich equations. Now, I found it very fortunate that Corvino and Schön did their work. things have changed now. What is global and was not global, that has changed. The constraints are, in the beginning, underdetermined elliptic. The Lichnerowicz equation and the York procedure are introduced to solve this underdetermined elliptic systems. And that makes also the situation global. But if you exploit the underdeterminedness, you have much more freedom. So I'm not so much worried any longer by this. Now, if you look at these conditions you write down, C5 equals 0, C6 equals 0, and so on, you have the feeling there's a general law behind this. You read it off. And if you look at this and assume that's regular and that's valid for all p's, you find that the sequence of conditions implies that regularity at all orders requires the solution to be asymptotically Schwarzschild, which is a very strong condition.
Do you mean exactly Schwarzschild in a neighborhood?
Wait a minute. Asymptotically Schwarzschild. But then, you know, we have a flat metric and the solution of the Lichnerowicz equation. That's analytic. And if that's supposed to be such, that thing is asymptotically Schwarzschild, it's in fact Schwarzschild in the neighborhood. So this is a very special situation we have here. Yeah. So, I mean, these are conditioned just at space like infinity, yeah? But since the solution is analytic, so it reduces everything to be Schwarzschild.
So you're claiming that the only example...
I don't claim. I mean,
Because you're not the only example which doesn't have these log divergences is
yes.
Exactly Schwarzschild.
Exactly, yes. Now, we have been...
There's an ancient paper by Bardeen Press.
Yeah, we want to go beyond the ancient part, yeah? No, I expected that you would smile when you see this. I was quite sure. Okay. Now, one has to interpret this to understand what it means. Yeah. Now, my interpretation now, it's not important that the Newman-Penrose coefficients are zero. What is important is it appears that regularity requires that the data correspond to the only static data in the class you are looking at. Yeah. The only static solution in the class of data which are asymptotically flat is the Schwarzschild, as the Schwarzschild data. You look worried?
Well, I'm saying there are much stronger results if you're assuming that the solution is static. Right?
Yeah. This is a very, very special example. Yeah. I want to understand what may be behind this, what kind of conclusion I could draw from this in general. Yeah. I come back to this. Now I understand this discussion becomes a little bit fuzzy because it's a very strange situation. We have some evidence for something and we want to draw a conclusion on the general situation. Yeah? And I have the feeling it's the best thing is to phrase it in this way. Though in general, I mean, in this particular case, it's much stronger. Yeah? If that's the point of the whole thing, then it's clear that the Newman-Penrose constant must vanish because they just vanish for Schwarzschild, yeah? That does not mean something deep about the Newman-Penrose constant. It means something deep about the smoothness question.
Yeah, but static space-time is definitely
extended. I come to this in a minute, yeah? Okay.
Still waiting.
Does Schwarzschild be no angular momentum?
Pardon?
Does Schwarzschild be no angular momentum? It's static.
No angular momentum, it's time symmetric. We are in a time symmetric situation.
Oh.
No, the angular momentum has the second fundamental form in it.
No. Yeah. Excuse me.
Okay, let's consider what we have in general words. And I'm referring to work which is much older. I studied the conditions which are applied on the initial data by having some regularity near space like infinity, first in the case where you have vanishing mass. Yeah? That was the first time I got this regularity condition star. In that case, I could even write down a condition which is necessary and sufficient. And later, I found that that condition is equivalent to this condition. So in the case where m equals 0, we know what the situation is. When I did this, I wondered, is it possible at all to construct data which satisfy this this regularity condition? I mean, it's a complicated condition, and how can you ever construct such data? And then I found that all static data, asymptotically flat static data with non-vanishing mass, satisfy this condition at all orders. Yeah. So the static field equation imply this regularity condition. Now we have seen that conformal flatness, non-vanishing mass, and regularity seem to imply asymptotic staticity. So I phrase it a little bit more general. And we have seen, in particular, if the mass does not vanish, this regularity condition star is not sufficient for the smoothness of square. So this raises a few questions. The first is, how is the mass doing this? How is this difference produced? Now, we saw that we had to go to fifth order to see the difference for the first time. So this is hidden somewhat deeply in the non-linearity of the equation. And I don't know any answer yet. Also, I mean, looking at the observations we have so far, one may wonder whether asymptotic staticity may play a particular role. I'm talking about asymptotic staticity here, because the calculation of the UP only need the data up to a certain order. Yeah? I do not want to have things really static in the neighborhood of space-like infinity. Nevertheless, it also raises the question, what happens if the solution are static? Is the whole picture I've drawn with the cylinder, is it okay in that case, or do you even get problems there? And that's what I'm going to discuss in the following. Just to remind you, static solutions can be written this way, with the potential V, which only depends on the spatial coordinate, and the metric H twiddle, which this should have a twiddle, which only depends on the spatial coordinates. And the Einstein equation reduced to this static equations, which are essentially three-dimensional Einstein equation with a kind of source field V. There's a conformal version of this for the following discussion. That version is very important, but I don't write it down. So I refer either to these equations or the conformal version of them. Now, what can you say in the static case? Turns out everything is fine. We know from the work of Baik and Seemann that on a given slice, the solution to the static field equation can be conformally rescaled such that everything is analytic in the neighborhood of the point I, which is space-like infinity. If one has this result, it's not complicated to show that these data evolve into solutions which are analytic at square. That's an immediate consequence of this if you to just make a suitable coordinate transformation. Now, if you want to analyze the situation near the cylinder, you really need to take account of the static field equation in a very, very detailed way. So the cylinder seems somehow to know what's going on in the equation. I've written here, in a suitable sense, and this comes back to the discussion we had before. I have these coordinates t, r, and xb, and I write down a particular frame which here has a factor r in front of the dr, and this is a dual frame. If I express now the metric in terms of these one forms, if I define connection forms by this standard formula with respect to these frame vectors vi, then I find that these coefficients are analytic and Lorentzian in the neighborhood of the cylinder. And the connection coefficients are also analytic in the neighborhood of the cylinder, which means that every formula you get by the standard formula of the frame formalism extends smoothly to the cylinder at space-like infinity. From this, you can deduce that all these functions up are a real analytic on the cylinder. So that's the situation as we would like to have them. And then you see that if you have data which are asymptotically static in the sense that if you make an expansion that up to some order it looks like a static solution, then up to that order, or maybe some order related to this number, all these up will be smooth. Now, I asked Piotr Kuschel about this, and they have recently written a paper where they construct many solutions, which are quite arbitrary in compact sets, but which are such that asymptotically they are static up to a given prescribed order. So there are many solutions which have this property, and for those solutions, you know that the UPs are smooth up to the order you want to. So the situation is not, yeah?
Excuse me, so for static solutions, do you still have non-trivial time dependence on the cylinder?
Yes, yes. You get something, yeah. The coordinate transformation, which you need to produce this picture with a cylinder is so to say time dependent. Yeah, it produces something. Yeah, you could say this, but in higher order you get more and more things, and I mean, you could say in higher order you're going also away from that point, yeah, to larger and larger extent, yeah, but I mean, it's not easy to make a clear statement about that.
So what does the time-like Tilling vector look like in a cylinder?
It has orbits like this here. It vanishes on the cylinder. It extends smoothly to everything. It vanishes the cylinder. It becomes tangent to the null generators, yeah, and it's perfectly smooth. So I hope you're satisfied now. Okay. So the question which now seems to be of interest is we have these regularity conditions which are necessary and sufficient in the case m equals 0, where the conditions with a star. We have asymptotic static as a condition, and somewhere in between seems to be this regularity condition which is necessary and sufficient in the case when m does not vanish. And what we would like to understand is where precisely is this thing lying? Yeah? It's certainly not agreeing with this. It should somehow be satisfied in this situation. It's not clear to me whether this coincides for this with this or something more general. I have a particular interest to have a nice hypothesis on this, because these integrals are very complicated to analyze. If one has a nice idea about it, one may find different ways of answering the question. It's clear this is referring to the time symmetric situation. In the non-time symmetric situation, one may expect that static is replaced by stationary. If we could answer this question in this more general case, we would have a complete survey about the those solution which have a nice smooth cry, and at least this is. I'm a little bit sloppy here. Of those solutions which can expect it to have a nice cry, yeah, we still have to do the second problem. Yeah. But if we can control this, I think we can be pretty sure, besides this, there's nothing which has a nice cry. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
One is when I have a hyperbolic surface or characteristic. In this case, there are no technical problems because of working terms, but there's the interpretational question of what quotient data could have possibly produced temperature.
Yes, yes.
But if I do the more standard thing, where I think of my data as a cutoff thing cut out of the quotient surface,
yes,
then there must be some reflection of these complications.
No. No. So there are three situations you have been referring to. The one is this full picture, where you have some complications here. Of course, I would be happy to see that you can do a calculation where you get the full picture in this setting. It's clear that you might have difficulties there. One has to see whether one can resolve this in a numerical calculation. In principle, you have perfect control over a neighborhood. Yeah? In principle, you could calculate an expansion to arbitrary order, which gives you some start away from this. Another possibility is to glue the data you are really interested in to something which is understood, for example, Schwarzschild. In that case, there's no problem at all. You know a neighborhood of this completely. Yeah? Even some of the difficulties inherent in the conformal approach, they just go away. Yeah? So another possibility might be in this setting you have perfect control on the conformal factor. So if you get close to squi, maybe you get a result which is interesting enough. Yeah, one has to see this. I don't know. I mean, I think there are possibilities also to handle this in a numerical situation.
No, this is clear. Yeah. No, the question was, so if I just go the naive way,
yeah,
okay, and I calculate some additional data,
yes,
where I don't care whether they really could small square,
yes,
calculate them up to some fixed radius,
yeah,
and do some numerical evolution, and then I try to make the radius bigger and bigger,
yeah,
try to carry out the limit,
yes,
but I haven't taken care about choosing my data,
yes. Oh, what that means.
Then there must be some reflection of all.
Yeah, then yes. I mean, if you just stick with a fixed radius, you wouldn't see anything.
Right.
I mean, if you stick with a fixed radius, the situation with the knowledge of the Schön-Corvino stuff is really strange. Yeah. What you have in this picture in your initial boundary value problem is you have a boundary which looks like this. Now, you're talking about this bit of Cauchy data, and you are talking about boundary data. It's very difficult to decide what the right boundary data are or not. Now, and you suggest you're starting from something which refers to this picture. Maybe you, in the beginning you calculated these data, and you have the feeling you're calculating the space-time resulting from this data. But that's not necessarily true. We know now we can modify the situation outside a compact set. Yeah. You can do all kinds of modifications. And these things, they will wander into your solution. Yeah. You simply cannot answer what's going on outside. Yeah? So you may have something which looks different from the thing you wanted to do, because in your boundary data, you're not able to decide what's going on there. Yeah? This is one thing. Now, you want to go further out, then you don't have that problem. But if you really would like to push it to the limit, then it's getting very, very delicate and complicated. That has to do with the boundary value problem. Locally, your problem looks like this, where the null cone looks like this. And now you want to push it to the limit. If you take a boundary value problem like this, at least in the setting which Gawinagi and I discuss, you can prescribe here the second fundamental, the mean extrinsic curvature, and you can prescribe certain components of the conformal Weyl tensor. I think it was Seifert. Depends on how you set up the frame and so on. Now, let's imagine we do a limit. We just shift the hypersurface. If you turn it this way, outwards, you're not having big problems to perform such a limit, and that's also natural because you know that in this situation you're allowed to prescribe certain data here, free data, the null data on this null hypersurface, and they just happen to coincide with this component of the conformal Weyl tensor. But if you're doing this thing, you know there's no freedom to prescribe anything at all. The limit is very, very delicate, and it's not clear how to perform this limit. Now, if you're pushing this just ideally to the limit, you're doing this limit. And I don't know how to handle this. I have no idea. Yeah? So on top of having these log terms, you're also having this problem. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
But a follow-up to such questions, given that it appears to be tricky to put asymptotic conditions so that you can guarantee there will not be an algorithmic term,
yes.
Then generic boundary conditions might give rise to the consequences of having logarithmic terms anyway.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah.
So if you do your numerical simulation in the standard of setup, if you look at your results carefully, there must be some echo of
the problem somewhere. Yeah, I mean, maybe it would be interesting if one can see this. I don't know. I mean, of course, these things come at a certain order, yeah? And I have no feeling of what this means. So the lowest order, the first condition which comes in is that the conformal Weyl, the Cotonc tensor vanishes at I. Yeah? Maybe one could do experiments where it does not vanish and see what happens. Yeah?
I know in the characteristic evolution, if you start off with initial data that has a certain analyticity as you approach Fry,
yes.
In the wildness, it can produce log terms unless you, in the evolution as well, unless you require that certain terms in the 1 over R expansion vanish.
It can or it can't.
It can.
Yeah.
It can.
Yeah.
So that you can start off with something without a log term. That looks
yes.
like it has an analytic expansion.
Yes.
Rock,
yes.
And then produces a log term.
Yes.
And you can see it right in the first time derivative.
Yes.
A log term. So so what you can do is you can require that this coefficient that produces the log term vanish. And Bondi was aware of this in his initial paper. That
yes.
You could require this coefficient to vanish.
Yes.
And we wouldn't produce a log term formally.
Yes.
But in a numerical simulation, as far as I know, I mean, I know our code, we don't enforce that this coefficient vanish. So there's always going to be some numerical noise.
Yeah.
That even if we don't start out with it, it's going to create it.
Yes.
So these log terms are essentially being created. You know, and at the level of numerical noise are starting to affect how many times Fry is differentiable.
Yes. If one understands how they are generated, I mean, by noise, or also analytically in the equation, and if one starts with data of which one knows a priori that sky should be smooth, I could imagine that one can take account of this by choosing the form of the equation such that this generating bit is not there. I don't know. One has to look at this. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess this is a situation where the analytical investigation may be useful. Yeah. In principle, you know, if you have hyperboloidal data which are smooth, you know the solution should stay smooth. Yeah. You know, it's then just a numerical artifact if you get something which behaves like this. Yeah. If one could identify and say it's this term in the equation, it's related to this and this geometrical thing, maybe we can do something in the equation just to avoid that problem. I don't know. One has to see.
Well, just to be more clear, what I did with press in the 70 or something was basically consider, you know, perturbations of Schwarzschild with the arbitrary time kind of Schwarzschild and asymptotic expansion in terms of, you know, basically the parts of one of R, and see how you get these wave tails coming in.
Yes.
If the solution is not static before some initial time. So, I mean, that's just something you can play with. I mean, you know, you have sort of a general solution constructed as a R series.
Yes.
See, just an example of play with, but it's all a progression of social.
Yeah. Maybe I should add something at this stage, because I mean, in your paper you also refer, if I remember correctly, to the Hund-Penrose constants.
Right.
Yeah, I mean they of course go away if it's Schwarzschild. Yeah, but we have seen all the static solutions are okay, and there are many which have non-trivial Hund-Penrose constants, and they are just there. Yeah, so I mean, I do not intend to invent the wheel again. I mean, it's clear that all these investigations somehow are related to this. But I guess if you really want to do this existence part, you have to go much, much closer to the details. Yeah. So you could say he's just adding in a few details. Yeah. It's just it takes some time because they are hidden somewhere.
But for the physical applications of this, it seems to me what you know already about the hyperboloidal surfaces are sufficient.
Yes, in principle, yes.
You spatial infinity to get the past, right?
Yes, in principle, I agree.
Past, we know there's all kinds of strange things going on in the past, including lots of matter and who knows what we'll never get control of.
Yes.
So we may as well just start with the hyperboloidal.
You could take the pragmatic position. This asymptotic flatness is something which is just added on the system we are really interested in to allow us to calculate the radiation. Yeah? I mean, this is something standing behind this. I mean, how do you define asymptotic flatness? Yeah? Some people think this is something given by God, but that's not the case. It's our choice, yeah, and that's the opportunity to show my pretty last transparency, which I prepare for the case when this discussion comes up. Yeah, we have 300,000 idealizations, and they are good for something, and one of these idealizations is this isolated system. Yeah, there are people who tell me, how do you fit your asymptotically flat solution into a cosmos? Doesn't make sense, yeah? The only thing you can do is you approximate a certain part of the cosmos by a certain part of this asymptotically flat spacetime, yeah? And the rest, that's your choice, yeah? And you have to do it in a nice way. And I think if one can answer the question I would like to answer, we know if we want to have a nice situation, that's the way to go. Of course, you could ask, are there situations where you need these logarithmic terms, where there is something physical related to them? I don't know, but before we can answer this question, we need to know the situation. Yeah? So from the practical point of view, I agree. Yeah? And maybe Sasha should not worry about this. Go on. Yeah?
Well, I think that's a good point.
No, for, yeah, I think for our setup, for the heuristic, one doesn't have to worry about it too much. But what the one gets very often is that, well, for instance, that the initial data problem on characteristic surfaces on hypermorphological surfaces is not very well understood, or it's not easy to understand it. The standard Cauchy setup is much better. So in some sense, that's very true. But in this sense, it's probably not true. As Charlie said, if you go around out the square, you understand what they're doing.
Yes.
But talking about space at infinity is talking about the infinite past, and it's something very very difficult.
It's difficult, okay. But I mean, one certainly gets a little bit more of interpretation. But the first thing you said, I mean, what shall I say? It took me a long time to learn the language of numerical guys, yeah? And if they talk like this, it's saying effectively, this is not what I'm interested in, this is not what I want to do, yeah? I mean, about this problem, analytically, almost everything is understood, we can say. Of course, you can always come up with harder question. If you crank up the data, what happens in the future? This is beyond analytical understanding at the moment, yeah. But in principle, it's...
Since one of the main objectives of the whole business is to model sources of gravitational radiation,
yes.
There is some interesting gap of in understanding, which is somewhat necessary to make a connection with actual measurements.
And even going out to scribe, in principle, there is all this tails right coming in,
yes,
which reflect behavior in the infinite past of whatever existence, right?
Yes.
So you don't escape that by going to scribe, just that you can sort of intentionally throw all that away and by demanding smoothness,
yes,
and something that probably physically is perfectly okay.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Not the generic solution, but
yes.
It's good enough.
But this, I think the point is that what we, at least for some purposes, we want. We don't want the imaginary solution, we want the physical.
Yeah, it is complicated to say what this means. I mean,
yeah. What do you mean by physical? I mean, what is, do we really care, what this, our system is doing, there is some principal information from all of that coming in terms of wave tails along, very close to sky, but it's all, very small, and I can't imagine it would have any effect on calculating what the universe is.
There might not be many quanta in those in those tails.
Right.
Well, this is why maybe if you do the Hamilton-Waddle way, that's maybe a clean way to throw out these things that you don't want. But if you do the standard way, then it's not clear that there's a clean way of cutting out the things that you don't want.
No, they are cutting out this. I mean, they don't care about this bit, I mean, unless it wanders at some stage into this. But you'll have not the slightest understanding of your boundary conditions, But it's even worse. It's even harder. I mean, this is something you can hardly analyze.
Well, our arguments rely on the fact, that you need physical boundary conditions.
That's wonderful. It's a nice word to cover something you don't understand.
There's a
contravariant
metric on the cylinder, but
not a covariant metric? Yes. So, you look at this here, and I say the GIK, that's smooth, and it's Lorentzian. Then this thing is smooth and Lorentzian, and you can write down this thing, which is the contravariant version of the metric. And you see that the V's have R as a factor, R, not as a factor of dr. It's not 1 over R like in the alphas. Yeah. So this has a smooth limit. So you have the cylinder, and there is this thing imposed on the cylinder. You have to take a limit. Yeah.
So what is it? What rank is it in the limit?
A three-dimensional metric.
Three-dimensional?
Yes.
Of rank 3?
Yeah, yeah. There's this degeneracy coming from the factor R here. Yeah, it's of rank 3, and in the cylinder, it defines a metric, a Lorentzian metric. It's a conformally flat metric. If you do this on Minkowski space, and if you take a boost, this extends also smoothly to the cylinder, implies a vector field, and it's a conformal vector field for this implied metric. Yeah. But don't ask me what it means. That's I'm trying to understand for quite a while. Because this metric is somehow related to the problems we have. If you draw the cylinder, then you find if you go up here and there's a degeneracy occurring again. Yeah? So if you draw the null curves for this metric, they are going around here, they're approaching this critical set and never get there.
The upper set is rank, it becomes rank 2 on the upper.
Exactly, rank. Exactly. So that's also related to this degeneracy of the hyperbolicity. That's my main occupation now to understand what it does, what it means. Of course, I mean, one can forget about the cylinder. You can write down coordinates where you don't see. But apparently, the evolution is governed by these properties.
Any other questions?